Call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is the 30th of March. We have a number of items on today's agenda. We are going to start out with a two public hearings and possible work sessions. As long as everything sounds good during the public hearing, we'll probably work the bills. That'd be SJM 10 and SJM 9. Then we're going to have a work session on Senate Bill 259. And then we've got two public hearings afterward, Senate Bill 361 and Senate Bill 882, in that order. So we will start off with a opening up a public hearing on SJM 10. Dan, you want to let us know what we're doing? And Senator Devlin, you want to kick us off? And any other electeds that are here for SJM 10?
I'm here, but we'll see how Senator Devlin does.
Okay.
There, you got a pinch hit.
That's right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Joint Measure 10 urges Congress to designate the Willamette Falls National Heritage Area. Sorry, mixed up my notes here. I had nine first. The Willamette Falls National Heritage Area, appropriate funds to restore and open Willamette Falls locks and facilitate the revitalization of the proposed area. And both revenue and fiscal impacts have been issued, and they're both no.
Okay. Great. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. I am here to speak in support of Senate Joint Memorial 10. This memorial urges Congress to designate Willamette Falls and surrounding communities as a national heritage area. This memorial communicates Oregon's support of federal legislation and executive action to recognize the Willamette Falls National Heritage Area and restoration of the Willamette Falls locks. It provides the centerpiece of our federal request for assistance. SJM 10 is an opportunity to take positive action to benefit the state of Oregon by encouraging federal recognition of the important aspects of our heritage. The proposed National Heritage Area includes history-rich communities along the lower Willamette River, including parts of Oregon City, West Lynn, Lake Oswego, and extending up French Prairie to the Willamette Mission State Park. National Heritage Areas present the interconnected stories of nature and human history. They are places with identifiable, nationally significant resources. They are places with stories of broad interest and public-private support for investment in the community. A strong base of local grassroots support is essential, with the visible involvement of commitment of residents, government, community groups, and nonprofits and businesses. SJM benefits are will lead to more economic development, more historic preservation, and more heritage-based tourism. This memorial also urges the restoration and reopening of the Willamette Falls locks to return navigation and riverborne commerce to communities upstream of Willamette Falls. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. I urge the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee to send SJM 10 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. And, Mr. Chairman, I would ask that Senator Olson carry the bill on the floor.
Mr. Chair, can he do that?
That's pretty demanding.
He can ask.
Well, you know, he is a direct chair of that Ways and Means.
That's right.
Any questions for Senator Devlin?
No, I would, Mr. Chair, I would thank Senator Devlin. He did a very good job of letting everyone know what this bill is all about. And remember that Oregon City was our first city in our capital of the Northwest.
Mr. Chairman, if I might interrupt, I have recommended previously to the Senate President, given the status of this building, if we should move from it. Now, it might take a constitutional amendment, but we should move the capital temporarily back to the territorial capital.
Territorial capital. That's right.
City.
Thank you.
What and if he's listening, he's probably emailing me right now or texting me.
Are there nicer facilities there than the PUC building?
We could look. Okay. It's either that or we can go back to Shampooey, and I believe state parks can provide us with some yurts.
Yurts, all right.
That's right. That would work.
Some tents and,
yeah.
Old school. Okay. Any other questions for the senator? Thank you
Thank
for
you
being
much.
Here and kicking off the bill. Before we get into further testimony on SJM 10. Senator Roblin is here for SJM 9, so we're just going to leave the hearing open on SJM 10, but we are also going to open up a public hearing on SJM 9. And Senator Roblin, if you could come forth, and Dan, if you could tell us a little bit about SJM 9, and then we'll move back to 10 after the sixth committee member leaves the...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Joint Measure 9 urges Congress to expedite the appropriation of funds to enhance efforts to monitor and prevent the spread of aquatic invasive species and to fully implement the Water Resources Reform and Development Act of 2014. Revenue and fiscal impacts have also been issued for this, and they're both no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. For the record, Arnie Roblin, Senate District 5, which is the wonderful part of the Oregon coast from Coos Bay to Tillamook and into the valley at Sheridan and Falls City. And so when I go around my district, I have to go through a couple other senators' districts to get to my other parts of my districts, the way the roads go. But it is a place that has no quagga or zebra mussels. In fact, the only place in North America that is devoid of those is the Pacific Northwest, if you include our Penwar region, which is the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, of which I am a member, and our legislative group belongs, the states of Oregon, Idaho, Montana, Washington, and Alaska, along with the five western provinces and or territories of Canada, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Alberta, Northwest Territories, and the Yukon, the only place left in North America that does not have the invasive species, either zebra or quagga mussels, that originated in our country in the Great Lakes, we believe, through ballast water exchanges from areas in the Black Sea and other parts of that country. In those countries, the limiting factor is the water amount of calcium in the waters. In our country, most of our water has a sufficient calcium, including the Northwest, to make it an amazing environment. And we've not been able to eradicate zebra or quagga mussels in any body of water that they've gotten into, except I believe there was once a quarry that got some in it, and they killed everything in the quarry, and they were able to destroy the quagga mussels as well. But in our country, it's been moving down the Mississippi, and it's been moving up slowly, very slowly, the Missouri, and it got into California and Lake Mead and a couple other places. And so what we are trying to do in our whole region is to try to make sure we don't get them here, because they become very expensive. The little demonstration thing you have up there, you can show people, that's 15 months in Lake Mead. Those are quagga mussels. They are the cousin of zebras. They're a little smaller and a little worse. They have a larger range in a lake from depth that the zebra doesn't. They are filter feeders, so they clean out the lake, which makes that indigenous fish have a harder time to survive because there's not much there for them to eat. But the other big problem for us is that they would really love our Columbia River and all of our dams, because dams are made of cement, which has a lot of calcium in it. And they would adhere to water intakes and all those other places, and we would have to continually clean them. So they expect hundreds of millions of dollars if they invade our area, and we have no way to get rid of them. The Congress passed a bill last year called and the President signed it, the Water Resources Reform and Development Act. In it, they authorized $20 million to be spent on keeping quaggas out of the Columbia River system with the Corps of Engineers. They never appropriated the money, so it's authorized but not appropriated. There's a bill this year to appropriate that we would like to have the Water Development and Related Agencies appropriations bills. We want them to appropriate the $20 million as well, so that they can actually start spending it and use it to help us figure out what we need to do to prevent this invasion into the Columbia River system. We felt that the best way to do it, I sent a letter personally to Senator DeFazio, who's on the committees, and this is a resolution to just let them know that the state of Oregon is really intense. We're trying to get the same thing done in the other Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. We aren't asking Alaska because the temperature variation means that they're probably not going to ever be there. I think we thought that in parts of Canada, but it's moved into Lake Winnipeg and some other places now, so we are concerned there as well. The Canadian provinces are doing it with their government to see if they can keep getting some more money in, but this is really to ask that money be spent on keeping the quaggas out. We have some people here that speak more to that and answer any questions you have, but I stand ready to answer any questions that you might have with regard to this bill and our little invasive species friends.
Thank you, Senator. An ounce of prevention.
Yes.
Questions for Senator Roblin?
Nope.
No questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a really good time.
All right.
Get your muscles back here, man.
Wait, I touched that. Do I have to wash my hand before
you're
I put
okay.
it in
we
the water?
You made sure these guys were completely sterile.
Okay.
Those are just baby steamer clamps.
I feel like
you
I don't want to
touch
anything
your ear
now.
And just watch out.
Okay, we're going to leave that public hearing open, but we are going to pivot back to SJM 10 on the Willamette Falls National Heritage issue, heritage area. So we'll call up Commissioner Tootie Smith and Carlotta Collette. And on deck are David Lewis and Jim Mattis, or Mattis. I apologize if I said your name wrong. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Edwards. I'm Tootie Smith, Clackamas County Commissioner. I'm also chair of the working group in Clackamas County for the reopening and repair and reopening of Willamette Falls locks. We have made great progress on that, and we're moving forward with this. The reason why this is important is because it was one of the first operational locks on the West Coast. It was opened in 1874 and was a main component of travel and commerce up and down the Willamette River. Since its closure, the largest river in Oregon has become non-navigable. And in the event, if there is, I say if, a large earthquake that renders our bridges impassable in Portland and Clackamas County, that would be our only way across and up and down the river. Willamette Falls and Oregon City are recognized at the end of the Oregon Trail. The Willamette River offered inexpensive and efficient transportation as well as hydroelectricity. PGE still transports electricity from that point and lights approximately 22,000 homes. It was the first hydroelectric power of electricity on the West Coast, and one single line ran from Oregon City to light the World Forestry Center in Portland in the 1911, I believe, World's Fair. And we have pictures of that, and it's quite nice. The locks are the nation's oldest continuously operated multi-lift navigable locks and were closed in 2011 due to needed repairs caused by age and deferred maintenance. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is currently the owner and operator of the locks. They struggle to receive federal funding because dollars are appropriated to lock systems transporting the most commercial tonnage, something that has diminished greatly at Willamette Falls since the 1990s under Oregon's struggling timber economy. Clackamas County cares deeply about the Willamette Falls and the three major efforts underway to capitalize on the area. First, the Willamette Falls Legacy Project aims to develop the former Blue Heron Mill site to bring economic growth and the development to the region and provide public access to the first time ever to the Willamette Falls. The county is a partner with Oregon City, Metro, and the state to make this reality. And I think you remember from last session, this body was extremely generous in allocating funds to help us do that. Second, the county formed a working group to support the repair and reopening of the falls, as I stated. I am the chair of that, and we have Polk County is one of the more recent counties that has signed a resolution to come on board, as well as the cities of Oregon City, West Lynn, Wilsonville, and we've asked all of the cities along the river from the Columbia down south to where it ends. Marion County has asked to be included on that. So we asked all entities, and I expect they all will join us in this resolution. Third, to designate the Willamette Falls as a natural heritage area. The county has advocated with our federal delegation for years about the importance of this designation. This legislation will demonstrate to the nation the essential role of the Willamette River and Willamette Falls plays on our state. Fortunately, I was in Washington, D.C. in February, and I met with an Oregon's delegation, and they all are very supportive of this effort. Senator Wyden, I asked for his unique assistance on this because, frankly, the Corps of Engineers were not very open-minded, let's say, on this. He has agreed to have a meeting. He's coming out to Oregon in April, mid-April, and is going to sit down with us and the Corps of Engineers and try to hammer out a deal. Concurrently, I asked Senator Merkley if he could help, and as you know, he sits on the Appropriations Committee, and he is going to make an appropriations request through their budget, and we have sent him what's needed to accomplish that goal in the form of an ask and paperwork. So we feel that this process is well on its way to this assemblage, and I believe that you folks may have already heard about a state task force being convened and passing legislation to help with that end as well. So thank you. Do you have any questions?
I don't have any immediate questions, but perhaps after the whole panel, then we'll see if everybody has any questions as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Carlotta Collette. I'm the elected Metro Councilor that serves District 2 in the Portland region. My district includes a lot of urban Clackamas County, including Oregon City, West Lynn, Lake Oswego, Happy Valley, Milwaukee, Gladstone, I know I'm forgetting some. And you have a copy of my comments written, so I just wanted to cover a couple of things that are not necessarily in my comments. Commissioner Smith mentioned the Willamette Falls and providing public access to that and redeveloping the Blue Heron site. This is a very important component of a complete package, and the National Heritage Area Coalition has been working to really hold that package together. It includes providing public access to the falls. It includes this National Heritage Area designation, and it includes opening up the locks to commerce once again. It's a very comprehensive and integrated package, and the goal is really to reintroduce to Oregon and to people all around the United States, and frankly, if we do our job right, to the world, what an incredible site we have at Willamette Falls and in Oregon City and at the locks. This is where the West was born. We have a little film that says, the future began here, and it truly did. This is where people came when they were founding the West. Oregon City was the first incorporated city in the West. We really are the birthplace of the West. And this is this designation, you don't actually have to do anything to help us get this designation except send this letter to Congress. So it's a pretty easy ask from you, although we'll probably be back with other asks that kind of fit together. Yeah. It's a huge lift for a part of our region that doesn't have the population and wealth that downtown Portland has. So we need your support. We need Salem's support. We need the rest of Oregon's support, because this is really a gift to the rest of Oregon. It is really reintroducing people in Oregon to their roots, to their heritage, right there at Willamette Falls. So thank you for your support. I hope deeply that you can submit this letter to Congress. It will be the first Natural Heritage Area designation in the West, in the Northwest. So let's be there first. We were the first. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Next up, David Lewis and Jim Matisse. And I'm sorry, I figure I got a 50-50 chance that I got it right.
It's Mattis, but I'll go with Matisse.
I knew it. I knew it.
Let me try. Next time.
Yeah. Either one of you are welcome to start.
Good afternoon. My name is David Lewis. I'm a resident of Salem, Oregon, also a member of the Grand Ronde Tribe. Used to be the tribal historian, and I sit on the Oregon Heritage Commission as the chair at this time. I've been a member of the Willamette Falls Heritage Coalition for about 9 years now, helping them write and research the histories in, around the falls, around the various themes that we've come up with, and I think you have papers to those effects. The main theme I want to talk about is the Native American presence at the falls. It was significant. The people, like the Clackamas peoples, Oregon City peoples, were there for upwards of 15,000 years, according to the latest archaeological evidence in the region. And so they control the falls. They fish. They maintain their locations in various towns and cities around the falls, above and below. And were only removed in 1850s to go to the Grand Ronde Indian Reservation after treaties were written, but with the tribes. So that was a very significant history for the tribes in the area. They helped with some of the settlement activities. They helped with commerce in the area in the early days. They were the portagers around the falls. They would feed people. They would provide a place to live when settlers and visitors came to their longhouses. And so they were part of the economy and commerce of the falls for a very long time. And that really is the basis of the foundation of why the falls are so important, because there's nowhere else where there's this almost an hourglass, this structure on the Willamette River that causes people to pause and have to walk around those falls, and the fish to, you know, have a little difficulty going over the falls and are easily caught that way. And that was initially the reason why the settlement of Oregon City was there, because it was an easy place to get food. It was an easy place to find find power from the water. And that was a good place to send your wheat from the Willamette Valley into Oregon City to be processed before it went to world markets. So that is why it's so important. That commerce, that industry at the falls, caused the government to be set up there, caused, you know, even the British government to really want, you know, the Hudson's Bay Company to really want to set up their property right there. And so it's a very significant place for a very long time, and it continues to be significant for us because it continues to be a power source and a food source for many, many people. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, I'm Jim Mattis, and I'm the secretary of the Willamette Falls Heritage Area Coalition. I could give you a very short overview of what we're all about. The Area Coalition had its genesis over 10 years ago when the then former then mayors of Oregon City and West Lynn gathered together to see how best to try to support our local museums and heritage-based organizations that were fast fading, and in fact some were actually closing. And they came up with the idea of having an area designated as a National Heritage Area to sort of pull a number of things together. We are currently a nonprofit Oregon corporation with a board of 23 members that is continuing to expand. We're a very diverse board and rather large, as you can see, made up by current and former city councilors and mayors and county commissioners, as your previous panel will attest to, as well as representatives from Metro, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. We have private business on our board, PGE and West Lynn Paper Company, for example. There's tourism and arts representations. There are numerous heritage-based organizations, including the Ice Age Flood Institute and the Willamette Falls Heritage Foundation, the latter which has been in the forefront for getting the more than 140-year-old Willamette Falls locks restored and reopened so we can have one Willamette River rather than two. In addition, we have the support of many other local governments, business, and heritage organizations in the area in our effort to secure the national designation. The Area Coalition and its partners all join in seeking that designation, which has no regulatory or land use authority, as a way to lift many boats vitally concerned with and invested in this area and in Oregon.
including stimulating interest in the heritage of the area and Oregon by telling the incredibly rich stories of the area, which includes, among many others, the fact that it was Americans on the Oregon Trail who settled here that was the catalyst for expanding the map of America to the Pacific Coast and the Pacific Northwest. Another boat that can rise is economic development through the heritage tourism business. We can envision sternwheelers and other vessels from Portland traveling south to the many heritage sites and beyond to the Mid-Valley wineries and the agricultural attractions of Oregon, like the Oregon Garden. Your support in this effort would be invaluable to us, and we certainly do seek it. And if you have any questions or additional information I can get you, I'd be glad to try and supply it. Thank you.
Thank you both for your testimony. Any questions for? Okay, no questions. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And a final panel on this bill, Yvonne Addington, Peter Hutala, and Lisa Nato.
Hello, I'm Yvonne Addington. I grew up in Tualatin, Oregon, was first city manager, spent the rest of my career in the state of Oregon, economic development. I retired, and I get to do all of these things now as a volunteer. The Willamette Falls Project is high on the agenda in the region for attracting tourism, economic development, while at the same time preserving the natural environment. So, the people who have spoken before me have told the story. I just want you to know that there is regional support. Tualatin is only 4 miles from the Willamette Falls via I-5 and I-205, which makes it a pretty good partner for attracting tourism. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Peter Hutala, Executive Director of the Willamette Falls Heritage Area Coalition, and I'm going to pass in the interest of your time and allow Lisa to take over. I'm here to answer any questions, though.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Edwards and members of the committee, I'm Lisa Nato, for the record, representing the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Peggy Sigler was unable to be here today, but you have her testimony in your packet. The National Trust for Historic Preservation wholeheartedly supports this measure and supports creating a national, designating this as a heritage area. Also, the National Trust has been working tirelessly. In 2012, they declared the Willamette Falls Locks a national treasure and has been working really hard with our local communities and educating people. I think a lot of people in Oregon don't know that the second largest falls in the country by volume of water is the Willamette Falls after Niagara Falls. And I grew up in Corvallis and didn't know that myself until recently. So Commissioner Smith has acknowledged the local cities that have stepped up to adopt formal resolutions in support of repair and reopening the locks. The counties, Polk County, Clackamas County, we appreciate her leadership in the working group. Metro has adopted a resolution in support, and the Grand Ronde Tribe as well, as you heard. So I'm really here to say thank you to the cities and the counties for pushing this through. Thank you to Senators Olson and Devlin for your support of this and leadership on this issue. And we appreciate that the state is now stepping up to say we unlock the locks and declare this as heritage area. So I appreciate all that you're doing today.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Is there anybody else that did not sign up that would like to testify on SJM 10? Okay, seeing nobody, we're going to close the public hearing on SJM 10, and I'm going to open up a work session on SJM 10.
Chair Edwards, I move Senate Joint Memorial 10 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Senator Olson moves SJM 10 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion on the... I will say that just because of the constraints of time of our committee for the entire session and how many bills that were put into our committee, I almost overlooked this one, I'll admit. But Senator Olson did a good job twisting my arm and laying out the vision, as did Senator Devlin. And I thought, oh, okay, now I get it. I didn't know as much as I ought to about this special place in Oregon and Oregon's history. So it's kind of an exciting bill, and I'm glad they prevailed and talked me into working this. So
we are too.
Any other discussion? Okay. Are there any objections to the bill? Okay. Seeing none, so ordered. And Senator Olson, would you like to carry the bill? Okay. Yes. Senator Olson will carry. We'll close the work session on SJM 10. And we still have the work session on SJM 9 open. I'm going to call up a few more folks to testify on it. Mark Sitsema and Tom Wolf.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks you very much for the opportunity to testify on this measure. My name is Mark Sitsema. I'm a professor at Portland State University, and I co-chair the Invasive Species Working Group of the Pacific Northwest Economic Region. Senator Roblin did a good job explaining the purpose of this measure. I'll just add that the estimated economic impact of mussels were to invade the Pacific Northwest is about $500 million a year. The impact in Oregon has been estimated at $100 million per year if these mussels were to become established in the state. Each state has a boat inspection station in the Pacific Northwest that's aimed at intercepting boats coming in from zebra and quagga mussel infested areas, bringing those organisms into the state. So if we could get this appropriation of funds from Congress, has a 50-50 match. So basically the funds available for these inspections in Oregon would double. It also provide the authorization also provides funding for early detection monitoring for zebra and quagga mussels in the state of Oregon. So there are similar memorials are moving through other legislatures in other states, so we're hoping that this concerted effort from the region will convince Congress that appropriation is appropriate for preventing mussels in the Pacific Northwest. So thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I want to take you back to the heady days of 2009 when the key word on environmental issues was invasives. About 14 invasive species bills passed on different levels, and the one that I'm most proud of is we helped pass one that set up with funding through the Marine Board and actual staffing by ODFW of boat inspection stations, because as Professor Sitsema has stated, the best way to prevent the harm from quagga and zebra mussels is to keep them from coming in. And so now we have 5 boat inspection stations around the state, primarily on the border, that check boats and have had done very well. Now, the only limiting factor is we need more boat stations, and SJM 9 would help get Congress moving to make sure we get that extra funding that could lead to more inspection, more work on preventing zebra mussels, quagga mussels, New Zealand mud snails from entering the Northwest and doing tremendous harm to the environment, to the infrastructure, and to the economy of Oregon. We asked for your support for this bill. It's a great bill. We urge you pass it. Thank you.
Thank you both. Questions?
I have one.
Yeah.
Professor, have they come up with, or has anyone come up with, a definitive killing device for these little boogers?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, there are several techniques available. One of them is potash. So actually you increase the salinity concentration of the water and the mussels can't survive in highly saline waters. There are chemicals or molluscicides that can be used. So there are a variety of techniques that can be used. The problem is many of those same techniques kill other things in the water. And as you know, we have many valuable iconic species on our waterways that would be damaged by some of these treatments. So again, as Mr. Wolf suggested, I mean, preventing their introduction is really the best, most economical way. Senator Roblin mentioned one case where in a quarry, so if there's no water flow, you can put stuff in the water and it doesn't move out. It only treats that particular water body. But those are fairly rare circumstances. So in sort of isolated circumstances that we could probably do something. But
follow up? Yeah. Are there any chemicals commercially available now for the cleanup of boats? I know we have the boat stations. If we find something, we clean them up. But are there any commercial products that are available for we boat owners that we can have and use?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, there the cleaning done at the boat inspection stations in the state is basically high-pressure hot water that's used to basically wash down the boat. Simple things like just putting a little bleach in the in your ballast tank for water, the boats that make a lot of waves. I don't do it.
Wave runners?
Yeah, those kind of boats. They have a ballast tank, so you can put some bleach in there. A few ounces of bleach would kill anything in the tank. So there are simple techniques that can be used, yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you both. Is there anybody else that did not sign up that would like to testify on SJM 9? Seeing none, we are going to close the public hearing on SJM 9 and open up a work session on SJM 9.
Chair Edwards, I move Senate Joint Memorial 9 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Senator Olson has moved SJM 9 to the Senate floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Olson, you've talked a lot about this issue on other bills. Would you like to carry it?
Absolutely. Otherwise, we can. Unless Senator Roland would like to.
You're carrying a lot of bills. We could certainly.
Roland. Well, let's offer it to Senator Roland first, and if he doesn't want to, I will.
We're not going
to
offer. We're just going to assign. Senator Roland will carry the bill, and we will close the work session on SJM 9. And okay, so moving on in our agenda, up next we have Senate Bill 259. Let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 259. And if the department could come forward and explain the amendments that are before us and walk us through that would be great.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Cornett. I'm the Assistant Director for Siting with the Oregon Department of Energy. So there was a public hearing on this bill on February 9th, and after that, we had several meetings with the investor-owned utilities to discuss some of the language in the proposed bill. And so the -1 amendments reflect the changes based upon those conversations and meetings that we had with the investor-owned utilities. So you have a memo. It describes the -1 amendments. There's three primary things that I wanted to point out to the committee. The first is with regards to the tribal reimbursement. So in the original bill, like local governments and state agencies, which are already allowed to get reimbursement for their work in the Energy Facility Siting Council process, the original bill included tribal governments as well to allow for their reimbursement. They play a slightly different role than local governments and state agencies. State agencies and local governments, their role is related to the rules, the statutes, the policies, the ordinances that get included into the council's process and become the council standards. So in effect, they kind of become like staff in the process. Whereas tribal governments, we rely upon them for their expertise on specific resources. So they'll get the information, they'll review it, they'll provide comments. So the roles are slightly different, and so the -1 amendments would still allow for reimbursement for tribal governments and their participation, but it breaks them out into a separate section to reflect that slight difference in the way they participate in the process. The second issue would clarify that legal expenses for state agencies and local governments, if they're participating as a party to a contested case, would not be allowed. So again, the way local governments and state agencies kind of act on as staff to the council. So if in a contested case, they're relied upon as an expert witness on behalf of the council, that would be reimbursable. But the implication here is if they are actually a party to a contested case, really what that means is they're in opposition to the application. And so this would not allow for legal expenses for them to oppose the project. The final thing that I wanted to point out, which is at the very beginning of the process, the notice of intent, the original bill would allow for, at the request of the applicant, some ability to consult with state agencies and local governments prior to submittal of the notice of intent, and it would allow for reimbursement of those expenses to the state agencies and local governments. The proposal in the Dash 1 amendments would require the department to do a cost estimate, so we would get some sense of what the applicant is intending to in their consultation, which agencies, the scope. We would do a cost estimate. The cost estimate would have to be agreed to by the applicant before we would move forward, and we would not exceed the costs that were included in the cost estimate without prior approval. So this would provide some more clarity for the sake of the applicant about the costs associated with that. So those are the three main points that I wanted to bring to the committee. There are a couple other clarification points. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you for your testimony and explaining the Dash 1 amendments. Other questions by members of the committee? Would you characterize these as this amendment as being a consensus amendment?
There's probably a couple of things that the investor-owned utilities were interested in, and they may testify to that today. I would say all of these elements that I described in here, there was agreement on. So there may be some additional things that they're interested in seeing, but all the elements that are included in here, I think we generally had consensus on.
Thank you. So before we move on, there are a couple of stakeholders that are mentioned, that are affected in the bill, that are mentioned in the amendments. I'd like to offer the opportunity, if anybody from investor-owned utilities would like to put anything on the record, project developers, local governments, tribes. I'm seeing, okay, saw thumbs up, saw, that means thumbs up, okay. Okay, so it looks like there's no burning.
But he said he wants to speak.
Oh, please, come forward then, sorry. And anybody else that wants to put their support or opposition on the record, I'd like to make sure that we're clear on where we all are before we move forward. So,
thank you, Senator. Brendan McCarthy with PGE. Very quickly, I've been working with the department. We've had several productive meetings. I think that we're in agreement with them on where they would like to go. I don't think we've reached a final agreement on the exact language. There are a few tweaks to the first part of the amendments. We don't argue with the cost recovery language for the tribes, but we are concerned about the pre-NOI consultation language. We haven't yet figured out a way to ensure that if we do participate in pre-NOI stage consultations, that we would be able to protect the information the department might receive in those consultations, which we would consider to be probably confidential business information, decision-making information, certainly, and it's the kind of information that we wouldn't necessarily want competitors to have if we were truly at a decision-making point. So we expect to reach agreement with them probably on the other side, but in the interest of moving this along, we're happy to do that.
Okay. Thank you. So for your purposes, you're comfortable with moving the process along and working with them on over in the House on finishing things up. You're comfortable with that?
Senator, I am.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Any questions for Mr. McCarthy? Okay. Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to provide testimony on this? Okay. Well, we are in work session, so I'd love to have a motion.
Chair Edwards, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 3/19/2015.
Senator Olson has moved to adopt the Dash 1 dated 3/19/2015 to Senate Bill 259. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, so ordered.
Chair Edwards, I move Senate Bill 259 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 259 to the floor as amended with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And is anybody interested?
Sure, why not?
Okay. Senator Brzozinski will carry the bill, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 259. And next, we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 361. Beth, you want to start us off, and then call up Richard Riggs and Alex Kyler and Rich Angstrom and Mark Nystrom. All four of you. We'll be able to pull up one chair and do it all in one panel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. We were the folks who bring you Senate Bill 361. Senator Brzozinski has been involved with a couple of situations, in fact, in Lane County with respect to mining. And it's a very contentious issue when neighbors especially are impacted by mining activities. And so we've brought a couple of different bills this session to try to address some of the concerns, one of which is this bill, and it has to do with improving communications between Dogami and local governments. This is a sort of an interesting procedure where Dogami and counties are both involved in permitting mining operations. And these activities really move forward not quite concurrently, but not quite in parallel either. And what the process entails, among other things, is that the applicant has to have an operating permit from Dogami and land use approval from the county. If it's clear, if you're a permittee, when you go onto the Dogami's website or visit with Dogami, you must get that land use approval, and they urge you to get down to the county very early in the process to gain land use approval. As the operating permit advances, they actually send a note down to the county saying, do you request more time, which is a procedure that is outlined statutorily? We will give you 165 days to process any land use concerns that you might have if you let us know that you need the full amount of time. That's done in various manners, a letter or an email. In Lane County's specific situation, in one case, we didn't find the letter or the email. It was filed, and nobody knew about it. And the silence that ensued was essentially a de facto, we're fine, from the county. And so the first phone call that the county received from a neighbor concerned about trees falling, rocks grinding, explosions happening at a neighboring mine site was really news to the county. And it is this situation that the county hopes to end through bringing Senate Bill 361, which would improve communications. The way we've introduced the bill, the version as introduced, suggested that a land use compatibility statement be issued by the county and delivered to Dogami. In subsequent conversations with industry, I think one of the very valid criticisms is we're almost putting ourselves too early in that process with a land use compatibility statement. I think Mr. Engstrom will suggest an alternative that he's come up with that I think we're fairly close to agreement on that will still work in terms of improving communications between the county and Dogami, but it's clear that we do need some sort of new process here such that we're able to answer that telephone when those calls invariably come and say, we are aware of what's happening in your neighborhood, potentially Cambio neighborhood. And I think this is incredibly important for us because the last thing that Lane County wants, as we're trying to build trust with our constituency, is to have people who have a terrible experience with the planning department. And so we're really trying to work on this communications process. I don't think the introduced version quite does it, but I'll let Rich speak to a concept that we don't have yet drafted.
Okay.
Good afternoon. I should go from there. I think that was a segue. Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. I am the mining guy. So here's what I really think is the issue, and I want to start it out this way, is Dogami has about 900 sites that they have permits around the, from around the state, and those are annually renewed. The local governments, all 36 counties, have what they call an inventory where they put on a map or in some kind of fashion all the mine sites that they're following. And what's interesting and where these things crop up, these miscommunications between the county and Dogami, is sometimes what's on the local government inventory map is not one of the permitted sites on the Dogami side and vice versa. Sometimes the Dogami permit is not on the inventory. And the latter circumstance is when there's a mistake. But what happened and what brings this issue to a forefront is in 1972, when the land use process came into effect, there were what the counties did is they inventoried all of their current sites that were operating, and those were all grandfathered in. Part of the big agreement was is we're not going to force all of those old mine sites and other things when the land use process went in through the new land use process. So you have all of these legacy sites that are still out there. And what's interesting in it, that's happening, I think it's a phenomenon of how difficult permitting, that results from the difficulty of permitting, is that companies now are looking more and more for these old relic grandfathered sites because they can't get through the permitted sites, and so they're activating them up and moving them forward. And in the case that result, in this particular case, that's the scenario. As I read this issue, I've never had an issue with better communications between all the parties. Mining, permitting a mine site in the state is a very difficult, rigorous, unfortunate process even. So better communications hopefully takes away some of the angst that goes on. My issue generally with the way the initial bill was that it really required the applicant to get through the local government land use process first and bring the LUC statement to Dogami and then start the Dogami process. And that wouldn't work because what happens in a permitting process is the counties really a lot of times rely on Dogami and the other state agencies as the technical experts on things like determining what the post-mining use is, which is what the counties are supposed to do, and whether there's noise or dust or other kinds of problems because in the case of DEQ, they're the ones that are evaluating those things. So it was not in a good spot. What essentially the initial bill did was put in Dogami's application process a land use requirement. I spent a lot of time over the weekend working this issue so we can get to a resolution on it. And there's actually a statute in 517.830, which is different than this one, that has and it's sub 3 through sub 6. And those three or four sections really delineate out how the conversation is supposed to go between the local governments and Dogami. And so I noodled on what it is the counties need. In those statutes, you will see, if you read them, there's multiple places where the Dogami is asking for input from the county about how they want to proceed on the application. In fact, the county in the statute can say, hey, I don't want you to make a final determination until we do. So the county has a lot of authority already in statute. And then it goes that even if the county says, I want you to hold up, Dogami, I want you to hold up the application, there's another part of the statute in sub 5 that says essentially that even if that happens, Dogami will still go out and try to elicit comment and recommendations on the permit from the local governments. I know this is kind of technical and nuanced. I can see eyes are glazing over now, and I'm sorry about that. But the point is that there is a better place to put this communication in statute that doesn't have collateral effect on the industry, and that clears up and makes it a little stronger the dialogue between Dogami and the local governments. And so Alex and I met at lunch, just before lunch today, and noodled on it. He had a couple of ideas on how to make it a little bit better, which I thought were excellent additions. I have it out for review by our attorneys to make sure it's drafted right, which is, you know, important that it's done right. And then hopefully we'll have an amendment for the committee that both the industry and hopefully Dogami and the local governments can all hold hands and say, hey, I think we've got a better way of talking to each other. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Love to see cooperation. Go ahead, Mark.
For the record, Mark Nystrom with the Association of Oregon Counties. Today I'm representing the planning directors. The amendments and the versions that we've seen, I just wanted to put on the record that the planning directors are okay with that. Of course, we're going to have to review the new amendments, but we support the work that Lane County is pursuing. That's it.
And Richard Riggs, assistant director with Dogami. I'd like to add a couple of things. I basically agree with what Mr. Kyler said, and would like to add a couple of comments onto Mr. Angstrom's testimony. Besides statute, our governing board's rules require us to circulate these permit applications as they come into local governments. And so there are multiple places in rule and statute and multiple opportunities for a local government to interact with us, and we will not issue a permit until we know for a fact that that land use is approved by the county planner. So there may have been an error in the past that has led to some constituent complaints that led to this bill being filed, but as a general principle and the way we do business, we make sure that land use is approved before we issue a permit. And there's multiple opportunities for those interactions to occur.
Great, thank you. We may have some questions for the panel. Senator Przanski, do you have any questions?
It's not really a question, Mr. Chair. What I'm going to say is a statement. The reason I was ready to bring this forward, and I did bring it forward, was for the communication part. I really do believe, based on what we know, where the left hand thought the right hand knew what was going on, but it turned out they didn't. Some type of affirmative act needs to occur so no one says, well, since we didn't hear back, we can move forward, as compared to knowing the files are complete. That's what I'm seeking for those constituents, and I think others. Rich and I and Alex have talked at some length, and we've also had representatives from Dogami together as to that, how important it is just to make certain we have that communication, because it will save a lot of angst for a lot of people.
Yeah, I could certainly understand how this created a lot of angst for your constituents in the particular situation at hand. You're saying what you want, Senator, is some sort of affirmative communication or notice, or so that silence on the issue isn't tacit approval.
Right. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. Something that actually shows that they actually got the notice that came to them either by written email or by, you know, mail, snow mail or however, but then there's something that goes back.
Yeah. Okay.
So close the loop.
Okay.
And I do want to thank everyone. I know at least two of the gentlemen were working this weekend. We had a little conversation on Friday, so thank both of y'all.
Thank you guys for being here to testify, and also the work that you're doing behind the scenes to try to get this issue ironed out in a way that works for everybody. So thank you. Is there anybody else that wanted that did not sign up that would like to testify on Senate Bill 361? See anybody? So we're going to close the public, or excuse me, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 361, and we're going to go to the last bill of the day. We're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 882. And while we're getting ready, not as many people have signed up to testify on this bill as I had anticipated. So we're just going to start off with Representative Holvey to kick us off. And I shouldn't have told him that it wasn't a big plus because he'll use it all the time now.
I couldn't have told you that.
Beth, you want to tell us what we're doing here?
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 882 would prohibit the application of neonicotinoids with some exceptions.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Since I'm, let's say, the chief sponsor on the Senate side, I am going to defer to Representative Holvey as to the work that he's done on here, and I think that what we know from that research, it's something that we really should be trying to tackle this time to really get something going in the direction of protecting the cycle of life that we need to ensure that we're going to have pollination where it's at, and we're not going to have a lot of unintended consequences that Representative Holvey will be going over regarding some of these chemicals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. Appreciate the opportunity to bring this bill forward and speak to you about Senate Bill 882. For the record, Paul Holvey, State Representative, District 8. I brought this concept forward, after recognizing some of the incidents we've had around the state and looking into this over several years about the what I would consider the overuse, and of course this is my opinion, the overuse of neonicotinoids in agricultural settings and plant settings, and whether it's commercial or home or whatever. It appeared to me that we needed to have a broader conversation, and I was largely disappointed with the outcomes of the Pollinator Task Force in looking into these issues. And the recommendations out of that Pollinator Task Force were required to be consensus recommendations. There was several split or majority recommendations that I thought were very good. I did bring this bill forward. It, I'm sure, to many of the stakeholders behind me, the nurseries and the farming community, seems a rather harsh approach. But I felt it was necessary to bring attention to this issue, which I think is much more severe than we're giving it proper attention. And so with that, I just want to describe a little bit about this bill. It does essentially ban the use of neonicotinoids in Oregon. So part of the reason for that is that it's having unintended consequences and hitting non-targeted species and having negative impacts on a lot of our environment, including not just what we largely hear of about the bees, but also all types of pollinators, a lot of aquatic insects. It's having impacts on worms and killing birds as well. And it's part of the story that we don't really hear about. And I've submitted several different studies to the committee to take a look at to back some of this some of these issues up. Neonicotinoids are a systemic type of pesticide. They're highly water soluble, which means that the plant absorbs them completely. The leaves, the stems, the pollen, the flowers are all become toxic to the insects that come in contact, eat, or suck some of the plant. And so that has led to some real basic concerns. We hear about the acute impacts, that we hear about that were where the linden trees that were flowering were sprayed and the bees came in direct contact and they all died instantly. That would be an acute impact. It occurs to me that, our response to that was, to make prohibit spraying flowering linden trees. But it certainly doesn't address all the other plants out there that happen to be sprayed and also the plants that are treated with neonicotinoids as well.
because they're probably just as toxic to insects as those linden trees. So that is one part. The sublethal effects are a little bit less talked about, and those impacts are sort of like lead in a way, where they're small amounts, and the insect can then continually get exposed to that, whether it's in the soil and the plant or in the water, and those impacts do affect the nervous systems, the memory, and the physical locomotion of insects, and it inhibits their feeding, which then leads to other problems where the insect doesn't know which way to go, doesn't know that it's supposed to eat, doesn't know it's supposed to, perform its basic functions, and as a result, then after a while, will die or its colony will collapse. The problem with some of those impacts is that the insects become toxic themselves, and then go on, birds that eat them become affected, fish that eat them become affected, and it just kind of goes on into the food chain of our environment, and especially in the birds that eat those. I submitted a couple studies about that, the study about the macro invertebrate decline and surface water polluted with one of the neonicotinoids, and then the acute toxicity that was noticed that with the bird decline, of grassland bird declines. One of the things that happens with neonicotinoids, they're used quite broadly. They're used as a prophylactic to prevent something that might happen. And to me, that seems like an overuse that's having negative impacts, when birds that can eat these seeds will die from eating the seeds. And so the plant absorbs, that neonicotinoid as it grows, and the whole plant becomes toxic. Another big problem is that it does, since it's highly water soluble, it gets, also the soil is treated. It gets into the water, and that is where it starts becoming a concern that the state of Oregon needs to pay attention to, because no longer are these pesticides staying on the private property where they're applied. They're getting elsewhere in our environment. And so when it starts getting into the water, that's when I become ultimately alarmed about the impacts of these neonicotinoids. That systemic nature of being highly water soluble means that it gets into the dirt, it flows into our through rain and runoff, and it just gets into the water. And that's been documented in a couple of different studies. USGS did its a broad-scale investigation of neonicotinoids just this last year in 2014, and found significant levels of neonicotinoids in all nine rivers and streams included in the study. And this study included several in Oregon as well. Also in 2013, the European Food and Safety Authority determined that the most widely used neonicotinoids pose unacceptable hazards to bees and other vulnerable species, and it prompted the European Union to suspend their use on agricultural crops. And since that time, they noticed a correlation of the improvement and increase in the decline in the mortality rate, I guess, of those insects dying. And so there's a lot of correlations that will point us towards that. As well, I know the Department of Environmental Quality has found neonicotinoids in the Clackamas River and the Hood River, the Middle Rogue River, the Pudding River, Walla Walla, the Yamhill River, and has also found it in the groundwater of the southern Willamette Valley. And though these amounts fall under the EPA recommended harm levels, it shouldn't really give us a lot of comfort, because, as discussed, this systemic nature of these, and they do persist for up to 6 years and more for these chemicals, and that they do accumulate when insects especially are exposed to it. So it tells me that we're using this stuff too much, from my opinion, and we're starting to see impacts to insects, birds, and you know, finding it in our water, at least begs the question of should we be taking a closer look at this? Should we be banning this until we can figure out what, you know, what is the proper use of this? When I look at our integrated pest management about how to protect this, it doesn't really apply to private property so much. And I know that the farmers and the nurseries are, you know, really do. I hate to take aim at their practices, because I know that they try to use the best products that are available to them. They follow the labels, and I'm not disputing that. It's just that I don't believe that the EPA and those labels are doing enough and have recognized the harm that some of these chemicals can cause. And I think it's incumbent upon this legislature to really take a look at this particular issue and really work towards a better solution that would limit the impact that neonicotinoids are having. Know that some of the recommendations that came out of that pollinator task force that weren't consensus were to expand the ban of use of certain of these pesticides, not just on linden trees, but to include additional vegetation that they shouldn't be on. And one of the other things that comes out is also that people go to the store and buy plants for their gardens and buy things, and you know, they're bee-friendly plants, and lo and behold, they've been treated with neonicotinoids, which are highly suspect and correlated to killing the very insects they're supposed to be friendly to. And they're not required to be disclosed on these plants as to that they have been treated. And so I know there's a lot of dispute about this, but I do commend these studies that I've submitted to you. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife has now, in 2014, declared that the use of all neonicotinoids should be halted in U.S. wildlife preserves just because of the impacts that they're having on wildlife in those areas. And, you know, I take those sorts of conclusions very seriously. I know that the EPA studies don't always indicate the concern that I think we should have. The European Union is also has put out a recent study that is linking neonicotinoids to nervous system problems in humans. Very, very late study that just came out as well. And you know, these are all concerns that I think we should be paying attention to. And at the very least, we should be looking at, does it make sense to treat the soil and treat plants before a problem has even started, you know, just as a precaution, as a prophylactic, when we're starting to see this in our water systems in the Willamette Valley and on the coast? It gives me pause that we need some better direction on best practices here, and I do not see that best practice coming forward from our agencies. I do not see it coming forward at this moment from the industry, and I think the legislature should ask for that, and we should put a moratorium on this and help some of our environment come back. And until we see our waters be rid of these particular insecticides, we should not allow this in the state of Oregon. So with that, I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Representative Holvey. Are there any questions for the representative?
Oh, yes.
What's that?
Maybe Michael would like to go.
You can go first.
Go ahead, Senator Olson.
All right, thank you. I read the study on the European study on neonicotinoids. They also said that after the discontinuance of use, that their crop production has gone down quite considerably on rapeseed because of the impacts of the little bugs that were getting in there. So how would you, or what would you provide as an alternate to a neonicotinoid so that our farmers can still be productive, because they went to this product because it is less impactful on the ecosystem, it's less impactful on humanity. This is a new chemical for that reason, been out since 1996. So what would you recommend they go to?
Well, I can't pronounce all the names. I know there are some alternatives. There's certainly the chemicals they were using before neonicotinoids. Some of them are more harmful, you're correct, to humans, but not quite as impactful to the non-targeted species in the environment. And at some point, we have to recognize that, you know, I think the industry, if challenged, that Bayer could come up with a better chemical if they were told that this one isn't working so well anymore. And I think they do that over time. And I think that, you know, that if they don't come up with them, maybe their competitor will. It's apparent to me that this one's causing harm. And so to say that, well, you know, we're scared of the alternative, it might be worse, it may not be worse. We know this one is having negative impacts. To just say that, well, we don't really have a good alternative, it's going to cause problems with our production, I think that's a challenge to the industry to come up with something that's not as negative, not as harmful to the environment. And hopefully they could do that. I mean, it doesn't make sense that in the name of slightly better yields that we're going to treat seeds with this and you know, have better yields at the expense of the rest of the environment. At the expense of pollinators that will, you know, have an extreme negative impact on their bottom line as well. So I think maybe there is a balance there. But you know, I want to see that balance, and right now I don't see that balance coming forward.
Follow up. Hopefully, it's non-technical because I don't think Representative Holdridge.
I'm not a scientist.
He's not a scientist, but
I understand that. I understand it. However, when one poses a ban, mm-hmm. one should understand what the repercussions are. Have you seen the Washington State assessment for neonicotinoid insect residues in and on bee bread and wax? Have you seen this study?
No, I have not.
This study is very definitive. It's what our state. I wish our state would do this. They have PhDs that provide this. They do gas chromatography on different tests, right. And they show exactly where they test throughout, and they even give the coordinates show precisely where they do the tests. And some of the things they said in here were quite interesting. And of that, and we're talking about bees, I guess this, let me ask this question. Was this precipitated because of the bee kill?
Part of it was, yes, but it was also that, you know, I was reading a lot about some of the impacts that this was having on earthworms and the impacts that this was having on birds. It wasn't just bees. Aquatic, the mayflies, caddisflies, for to name a few others. I mean, it's the problem is that we're impacting non-targeted species just as much as we're impacting the targeted species, and so that became a concern of me. And granted, I will give you that there are studies, you know, that will tell you that they're safe, and studies that will tell you that they're not. We have all of those, you know, studies available to us, and. You know, for years and years, EPA has been telling us that Roundup's safe, and now we find out that it's a carcinogen, you know. And so, you know, at least that's the latest study. And so, you know, I think as science evolves, we need to evolve with it and recognize that we learn things about these chemicals as time goes by, and we should be in a position of trying to react to that instead of ignoring it. And trying to push, you know, the manufacturers to come up with a better solution. I don't think the neonicotinoid is a very good solution.
This one last follow-up, and then we've got eight more people.
That's fine. I will just say that we have a PhD that says good science that shows that neonicotinoids are safe for fish and wildlife, that the alternative pesticides that would be used if these products were banned will cause bird and fish kills, and that problems in the U.S. honeybee industry are not a result of pesticide use. And I
have studies that refute that, and I can call it bunk, so, you know. You can call mine bunk, and I'll call yours bunk.
So then we dictate legislation on bunk.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that we should be precautionary and taking steps to make sure we're not having negative impacts until it can be shown that we're not.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm curious about the structure of the bill. The bill basically prohibits the use of these neonics, but it gives the Department of discretion on where they can be allowed. And, you know, I'm wondering, particularly with this discussion of bunk versus bunk, you know, how you expect the department to proceed in the rulemaking on this.
Well, I put that in purposefully because, you know, if the department sees an outbreak that needs to be addressed and they really see that this is the only way to address it, you know, I wanted to make sure they had the ability to address it. You know, I mean, some of my, you know, so I'm recognizing that maybe it is the best alternative in some serious conditions. And so in a serious, you know, emergency type of outbreak, they can address it. But what I'm really speaking to here, though, is that it's used so widely for everything, and it's used on seeds, it's used in the soil before there's even an outbreak, and you know when and now we're seeing it in our watersheds and in our groundwater, and it has a cumulative effect to invertebrates, and you know that to me is alarming. You know I think that the chemicals are being overused, and we should, you know, take some precautionary steps in that, you know, and I'm more than open to what those might be.
Okay. Senator Przanski, then Senator Thompson. Then we need to move on.
Yeah, I was wondering, Senator Olson, if regarding the PhD that you're referring to, I'm looking through the material we have. I see a letter that's come from Bayer's crop science PhD, Dr. Fisher. I wonder if that's the letter you're referring to.
No, I'm actually referring to the letter from Ann Farbrother, DMP, PhD.
Okay.
And it is on OLIS.
Yeah, no, I saw that one too. It just always, when I see these, I always have to think about the who, what, why, and when, and who paid for the study, and all that good stuff.
Senator Thompson.
I just want to make a quick comment on what he's made about, Rep. Hovey's made about spraying, and when there isn't a problem there. The thing with this chemical that he's referred to is what I know is like in the apple industry, maybe it's used, and I'm not sure if it's used now. We don't have any apples anymore, but we used to, and you could apply that at an early stage of the season and not have to worry about aphids the rest of the season because of its systemic nature, whereas you might you'd go in and maybe put some chemicals that were before this that are a lot more harmful on the environment, and you'd have to maybe make three or four applications to control that pest for the season. When this time, with this one, you could do it once. So if you have apples, you know you're gonna have aphids. You can count on it. It happens every year, it just happens. They don't come one year and go back and forth, you always have them. So that's why this chemical's got so popular, is because you can apply it. You can even apply it on the, like you said, on the ground, and the tree takes it up, and you don't have aphids for the whole season. So that, I think that's some of the reasons that that's there, but it also saves a lot of worse type chemicals maybe being applied. So that's why this product's come along.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Thompson. Representative Hovey, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm going to excuse you now because we need to move on. And so thanks for being here. Thanks for kicking the bill off. We're going to go with Ann Farbrother, Jeff Stone, and Scott Dahlman.
She's here.
Excellent. Okay. I should ask her the question then.
There you go.
So we are going to, we've got eight people yet to go. If each of you take 10 minutes, we won't get through all eight people, and we'll be here till 6 o'clock. So,
and some of us will be
think
leaving
three, like 3 minutes. Three would be a really good number if you could hit that. And then, you know, if we need more testimony, you can certainly turn everything in. And then, if we need more time to process this issue, we're going to always have another public hearing. So. Go ahead.
Certainly. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Ann Farbrother, and I'm here today to stand up for good science. This is what I've done throughout my 30-year career. I've worked half of my career for EPA as a research scientist in the lab in Corvallis, and the other half of my career I've worked as a consultant to industry and various governments on issues relating to wildlife toxicology. I'm a veterinarian by training, and I have a PhD in wildlife diseases and environmental toxicology. And although I've consulted for the pesticide industry, I am now retired, and I'm here today on my own and on my own behalf, and I am not being paid to testify. As I said, I am here to stand up for good science. I'm asking you to carefully consider the large body of really good science that shows that neonicotinoids are safe for fish and wildlife, and that the alternative pesticides that would be used if these products are banned will cause bird and fish kills, and that problems in the U.S. honeybee industry are not the result of pesticide use. The neonics are designed to be very specific to insects, so they do not cause problems directly to fish and wildlife. They don't remain in the soil long enough to build up in the food chain. If farmers are denied the use of these products, they will use older pesticides, the organophosphates, the carbamates, the pyrethroids, and we will once again see bird and fish kills, and we'll also see more impact to aquatic invertebrates. The current 2-year moratorium on neonic use in Europe has caused huge problems for farmers there. A flea beetle outbreak wiped out about 40% of the UK canola crop this past year, where in the past the neonics have been very successful at controlling this pest. This tells us that there can be negative consequences to agriculture if we have a ban on these chemicals. You must remember that the dose makes the poison. There have been a lot of studies done in the laboratory that show effects of neonics on individual bees, particularly on young worker bees, on their behavior, survival, locomotion, and so forth. But these are conducted at high concentrations, as scientists are trying to find out what is possible, but they do not tell us what is probable and what might happen at field realistic conditions. A recently published study by USDA scientists has convincingly shown no effects to bee colonies exposed to field realistic concentrations of neonics in pollen. And when France banned the use of neonics on sunflowers, their declining honeybee populations did not recover. I leave you with a reminder that the honeybee is not native to the U.S., but was brought here by the pilgrims to provide honey as a source of sweetener. Market forces, diseases, and basic husbandry problems are primarily responsible for difficulties the honeybee industry has faced in the past 2 decades. Pesticides are very low on the list of problems for these bees. I hope you consider very carefully what is known as fact, what is speculation, and what the trade-offs are when considering a ban on any pesticide. I have put into the record a copy of a journal article that I wrote about the risks of neonics to bees, and this provides a lot of the detailed science behind my comments. Science does have a lot to offer. Use it widely. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you for your testimony. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I am Jeff Stone. I serve as the Executive Director for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I have submitted a plethora of materials for the committee's consideration, and I'll focus my attention today just on a couple different elements. First of all, pollinators are very important to the nursery and greenhouse industry. We need them. They help us grow our plants. We are one of the biggest nursery states in the country, so our interaction with the pollinator community is very important. The second part is, if you want to be pro-pollinator, there are 3 bills that came out of the task force. All of them are worth your consideration. We can get you additional information there, but today we're talking about neonicotinoids. So let's talk briefly about bee health. After the bee kill in Wilsonville on National Pollinator Day, that was not awesome, by the way, I had to learn a lot about this issue. So what's the role of pesticides? Well, not as much as you think. First of all, Nutrition is a big factor for pollinator decline. They have to travel farther to get the type of food that they need. So we need to have greater diversity of plants for them to feed on. Second is biodiversity within the bee population itself. A culture that does not have the diversity will not succeed. The last one that was the holy smokes moment for me, when I was testifying before Congress on this issue, a USDA scientist talked about the varroa mite as a very cool but ugly name, the varroa, the destructor. It is one of the biggest threats to the pollinator community. In relative size, the varroa mite is this big to you, Mr. Chair, and picture 12 of these on you and me, and I go home to my family, and then 12 get on them, and then it spreads to school. It goes everywhere. The varroa mite, if you think of it, it's inexact. I'm not going to have the scientists contradict me, but it's like a little vampire that is parasitic. So it is one of the biggest threats to the bee colony. And so what we should do is look at not the science that's convenient. We should look at the science that brings this issue forward and helps the pollinator community. So you have the balance of my time and my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Dahlman. I'm the Policy Director for Oregonians for Food and Shelter. As a reminder, OFS is a grassroots coalition representing farmers, foresters, and other pesticide users, all who have an interest in this issue. The issue of bee health is important to all Oregonians, but especially to our farmers, because they need pollinators to pollinate their crops, but they also need pesticides to protect those same crops from pests. We need to make sure that those two things are not mutually exclusive, and we don't believe that they are. I want to make a clarification on a couple of things that have already been said. One, when we talk about the incidents that occurred over the last couple of years during National Pollinator Week, as Mr. Stone mentioned, those are misuse of pesticides. We can all agree that if you misuse these products, they can cause harm. But that is not the norm, and we have things in place to react to those. The people who made those mistakes were held accountable by the Department of Agriculture, as they should be. It was brought up about the ban on four of the neonicotinoid products on linden trees that was recently put into rule by the Department of Agriculture. Why that was kept to linden trees is because linden trees are unique in that they can have natural toxicity to bumblebees without the use of any pesticides. And so the department believed that there was a confluence between the natural toxicity of that particular species of plant in conjunction with the pesticide is what could cause potential problems. And that's why the rule is related to that. So why are neonics important? Neonicotinoids have been used for more than 15 years and widely adopted by growers and urban applicators. That's because of their performance, their lower toxicity to mammals, including humans, making it safer for people around and especially for the applicators, and their relatively favorable environmental profile over the products that they replaced. Senator Olson made a great remark. If you take these products away, what are you going to replace them with? The options you have to replace them with are much more harmful to the environment and come with their own sets of trade-offs. There are uses for those products, but the reason the neonics are used so much now is because they have less of those harsh trade-offs and are less of a risk. They're extremely effective against invasive species, and have some systemic insect control that's not provided by other chemical classes. So we need to take a step back sometimes and remember that these products are very, very highly regulated. They're regulated both at the federal level by EPA and at the state level through registration. That means these products at the federal level have had extensive safety testing before they were put on the market for honeybee acute contact toxicity, honeybee acute toxicity on foliage, and field testing for pollinators. Those tests have been done on all of these products before they come to market. We're not just second-guessing this now. Oregon has taken a proactive step to address pollinator health. You heard Mr. Stone talk a little bit about some of the concerns around pollinator health. This committee passed a bill which sent us out to be on a task force, which I was a part of as well, and we got to spend the summer taking a deep dive into the issue of pollinator health. And what came out of that deep dive was four recommendations that you all have and that have been put in bill form in the House, and we're hopeful will come over. Those are the things we're recommending you support. After taking a deep dive into this issue, that was the recommendation that came forward from a diverse 10-member task force. So what does the science say? You've heard a lot of debate about this scientist versus this scientist. And so I think it's important to take a look at what some of the regulating agencies, both in the U.S. and in other countries, have concluded on the issue of neonicotinoids and their effects on pollinators, because these agencies are charged with looking at the body of the scientific evidence and making a reasoned decision. EPA has been petitioned to ban these products, just like you're being asked to ban them right now. In response to 2012 petition, EPA concluded that, quote, it is not aware of any data indicating that honeybee declines or the incidence of colony collapse disorder in the U.S. is correlated with the use of pesticides in general or with the use of neonicotinoids in particular. EPA also said that they are not aware of any data that reasonably demonstrates that bee colonies are subject to elevated losses due to chronic exposure of this pesticide. We look to our friends in Europe. The UK Department of Environmental, Food and Rural Affairs, who was opposed to the European moratorium that went into place, said, while this assessment cannot exclude rare effects of neonicotinoids of bees in the field, it suggests that effects on bees do not occur under normal circumstances. This assessment also suggests that laboratory-based studies demonstrating sublethal effects on bees from neonicotinoids did not replicate realistic conditions, but extreme scenarios. Consequently, it supports the view that the risk to bee populations from neonicotinoids as they are currently used is low. Finally, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicine Authority, and Australia is notable because they have extensive use of neonicotinoids on their farms. But they are not seeing the colony collapse that we are seeing here in the States. We have the varroa mite in the States. They do not have the varroa mite in Australia. The Australian government said the introduction of the neonicotinoids has led to an overall reduction in the risk to the agricultural environment from the application of insecticides, and that Australian honeybee populations are not in decline despite the increased use of this group of insecticides in agriculture and horticulture since the mid-90s. So I know you're using a lot of time. So in conclusion, the interaction of bees and pesticides is a very complicated issue. It's being taken very seriously by growers, manufacturers, and regulators. EPA is working hard to make sure these products are being used in a safe manner, and pesticides are just one part of a bigger picture. We believe a thorough review of the data shows that neonics are a safe, effective tool for protecting health and property, and a ban will result in less options to contain destructive pests with little of any benefit to bee populations. In light of this current science, we urge you to oppose this bill. I do have to make one more note on slightly unrelated, but there was something stated about glyphosate earlier. And we continue to maintain that glyphosate is a safe product. It was ruled by a World Health Organization subcommittee to be a possible carcinogen, which puts it in the same category as coffee or working night shifts. This is in contrast to all the other reviews that have been done of the product, and I just, for the record, since it was stated earlier, wanted to get that out there. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Rich, for your testimony. Questions? Senator Przanski.
Yeah, thank you. Doctor, I appreciate your testimony. I reviewed very, very quickly the paper that you've submitted to us. And looking at it, I see the acknowledgement. I really appreciate that it is acknowledged. As it states, the funding for this development of this manuscript was provided by Bayer Crop Science Ag Research Division. So can you give us a little bit more information as to what they funded? Because it sounds to me that they were somewhat instrumental in providing you the resources necessary to produce this document.
Yes. in response to that, they did provide some funding for supporting For My Time, and they paid for the publication. They had no editorial oversight on the paper and did not were not in a position to provide any comments that we as authors needed to respond to.
All right, if I can follow up. Regarding Bayer Crop Sciences, they're into the business of selling insecticides, herbicides, and fungicides. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And have you worked with them prior, besides this one paper, have you had relationships with them before?
Yes, I have, actually, starting from when I was working at EPA, when we did some cooperative work together. And then since then, on several of their different products, I've consulted with them and provided advice about the potential risks of their products to birds and other wildlife.
Thank you. One last one, if I could. And that's, I guess, just understanding how these processes work. It's my understanding that Bayer Science, our crop science, has been involved in this area of the industry, that they basically are promoting their products. I understand that from the way that they go to the EPA, they will provide the studies that have been done and then give them to EPA for their review. But the studies themselves, the research, is actually done by the company that's promoting the product to go onto the market?
Yeah, so the registration process for all pesticides in the U.S. Mm-hmm. is that there's a standard suite of tests that are required for all products to get registered, and the registrant has to run those tests. However, they have to do that in laboratories that meet what's called good laboratory practice standards and that are overseen and audited by the EPA. And all those data have to conform to the right protocols that were written and produced by EPA. So EPA says, here's how you're supposed to do the tests and all of the quality assurance stuff you need to do. And then the companies run the tests, and they send all the data to EPA and a test report. Then EPA does the risk analysis. So the company produces the data, but EPA does the risk analysis.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Doctor, thank you very much for letting me quote your statement in here. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions, comments? Okay. Thank you each for being here and your testimony. Next, on the other side of the issue, we're going to call up Tom Wolf and Pat Williams. And then the final panel after these two folks will be Barry Bouchou, Blake Rowe, and Michelle Armstrong.
I would ask if I could go first, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
I'd like to go first. My name is Pat Williams, Patricia Williams. I'm from Salem, Oregon. And I was a public observer of the Pollinators Task Force.
For be back away from the mic just a little bit. They're super sensitive, and they pick up any rubbing or anything.
Yeah, I was a public observer for the Pollinator Task Force, and like Representative Hovey, I was very disappointed at the lack of any real strong supportive measures. I'd just like to speak to, and the reason why I want to go first is because you will be able to put the issue a whole lot better. I would just like to make a couple of comments. When Rachel Carson published her Silent Spring, the chemical industries came out in attack with all sorts of reports that contradicted her. And, you know, two decades later, DDT was banned because the more and more evidence became evident to people that DDT was a problem. And what we're having with the neonicotinoids is another Silent Spring type scenario, in my opinion. The sublethal problems that the bees have will make more long-term issues. In the bee colonies today, they have found pesticides accumulating in their combs, and there cannot be no harm to that. And with that, I will, and also the disorientation, bees have to communicate to other bees where the food
is, and that is lost with this low-level sublethal information. With that, I'd like to close and depart, if you all don't mind.
Go ahead, Tom.
Chair Edwards, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. My testimony is on O-List, as is two papers that I turned in. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time because I'm a great believer, as many of you have heard me said, that, you know, the Gettysburg Address took 2 minutes, so I can do this quickly. So Trout Unlimited supports this bill, not because of the bee issue, because that's not in our wheelhouse, but because of the impact that neonicotinoids have on aquatic macroinvertebrates. Both studies that I submitted talk about that, and I won't quote those or go long into this, but there's four problems that these neonics have on macroinvertebrates. First of all, there's a high water solubility. There's a broad use of these that increase the amount that goes into the water systems. There's environmental persistence. Once they get in, they last for a long time. And there's a high non-target toxicity. So they they have a major impact on species they weren't targeted for. So I asked, not necessarily that we ban this, but we look closely at the impact of these chemicals, neonics, on macroinvertebrates, because as many of you know, have heard, that fishing brings into and angling brings into our economy close to $1 billion a year. Anything that will, and I know that the agriculture industry brings in more, but let's not have a negative impact on rural communities that depend on people coming in to fish in their communities. This could possibly have an impact. Again, not asking that these be banned, that we work together to look at ways to limit the impact that these have on macroinvertebrates. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Any questions for Tom? Thank you. And now we'll go to Barry Bouchou, Blake Rowe, and Michelle Armstrong.
Go ahead. Got to get those. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Blake Rowe, and I am the CEO for the Oregon Wheat Growers League. We represent nearly 2,000 farms that produce wheat in Oregon. We're relatively quiet. We account for some 31% of Oregon's harvested crop acres, 13% of Oregon's agricultural exports, and have a footprint, direct footprint of roughly $400 million a year in Oregon's economy. So wheat is largely a self-pollinated crop. We have virtually no interaction with pollinators, although many of our growers also grow crops in rotation that require pollination, for instance, canola. We do use neonicotinoid products. Those products would be prohibited by SB 822. Primarily, these are as seed treatments applied to the outside of wheat kernels before they're planted to control damage from soil insects like wireworms and plant pests like aphids. Those pests are endemic in the environment, so it's not like we wait until you see an impact. These are, in fact, used as described as a preventative measure. So a common product that we use, and I provide this just to give you a perspective on amounts, is called Cruiser. It is the product used commonly in one of those seed treatments. Roughly 1 ounce, so the amount in the water bottle here, is the amount of active ingredient that is used to treat 75 pounds of wheat seed. That would be what it takes to plant an acre of wheat field, roughly a little bit smaller than a football field. So again, I'm just trying to give you perspective as to this is in our application. This is the amount of product, and I guess you'll have to decide whether you think it will stay in place, but it's applied to the wheat seed and then usually planted with drill put into the ground. We do have older chemistries, you're correct. We could substitute some older chemistries that we don't think are beneficial, they don't do the job as well, and probably represent more risk to the environment. But again, we just wanted you to have a feel for our application of neonics. maybe on a more philosophical, I'll do this quickly. You know, regulations are designed to allow for the beneficial uses of things and beneficial uses from activities while controlling the potential for harm. That's sort of the principle of regulations. We regulate countless things, from alcohol to motor vehicles to recreational activities and everything in between. Thankfully, we rarely react to clear violations of regulations by banning the product or activity, which is essentially what is being proposed here. There were some problems, clear violations of how neonics were supposed to be used. And in response, we're contemplating banning an entire class of chemistry. Beneficial uses go out maybe with the bathwater. It strikes us to be a little bit of an overreaction to the problem. I would commend ODA. I think they have brought a relatively reasoned response to the issues that we face. And finally, I might just suggest that you heard a comment earlier about the protocols that EPA uses in their reviews. And I think EPA's protocols are very good. You are correct. The company does the work, submits the information and the data to EPA standards for EPA's reviews. Well, I am not an expert on those protocols, but I would suggest as you review science, those are pretty good protocols. So as you look at scientific study after study, particularly those published on the Internet that aren't reviewed by the EPA, ask yourself if they would be able to pass that EPA review. It's oftentimes more about the standard of the study, the quality of the data, and who's reviewing it than it is about who does it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Senator Chair Edwards, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My wife and I farm up near Gresham, Oregon. We raise about 100 different crops and cultivars. The cultivars, of course, is the biggest number, but we raise flowers, we raise vegetables, we raise berries, we raise pumpkins, we raise corn. Berry Bashew. And I also, I'm also the president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I'm here today to oppose Senate Bill 882. You know, in a perfect world, there wouldn't be pests, there wouldn't be diseases that impacted agriculture, but it's not a perfect world. And these chemicals, the ones that we're talking about today, are critical to the overall tools that we have in agriculture to fight the disease and pests that we have. In this case, it's an insecticide. It would be nice if obviously we could do it in a different way. We can't. They're very expensive. They're not a cheap part of our budget. As Blake pointed out, the amounts used of these neonics is incredibly small. One of the previous speakers, I believe, was Representative Holvey, talked about precaution. I would point out that this is one of the labels for one of the pesticides that we're talking about that comes with every single container that you buy. The work that EPA has done through FIFRA and the cost of over 10 years and upwards of $100 million is the precaution. And what we have here is a result of that precaution. I know some of you are concerned about the impacts that the chemical companies have on these. My suggestion would be is that if they had as much power and authority as we'd like to think they have, it wouldn't take 10 years or $100 million to put a product in front of farmers like myself. We raise a lot of diverse crops. We need these chemicals in order to stop a loss of a product. In fact, this morning I actually applied a chemical, a neonic, imidacloprid, in the form of a granular to some of the flowering baskets that my wife raises. Whitefly and aphids are an incredible problem inside of our greenhouses. There are a limited number of crop protection chemicals that we can use in our greenhouse. The neonics are the most safe for human use, the most safe for me personally applying them. The alternatives, organophosphates, some of the carbamates, and some of the pyrethroids are considerably more dangerous and considerably more active in the environment. We raise a lot of crops outside as well. Most recently, one of the most major crops, a crop pest in soft berries and soft fruits, has been the spotted wing Drosophila. One of the most effective uses for a neonic is to kill those products in berries. We lost our berry crop this year because I didn't use them. It was a very small crop. We have folks coming to pick them. I didn't have the timeline necessary, so I lost that crop. Had I been a little bit more proactive and used the kind of chemicals I needed, I wouldn't have lost that crop. I can't afford to lose those. We're a small farm. It's just my wife and I do 90% of the work. My kids, when they're home from their own jobs, and once in a while we hire some folks to give us a hand. But for the most part, it's us. We can't afford to lose these crops. And if you start banning these products based on what I think is bunk science, and I guess we're going to get back to bunk versus bunk. But I guess in closing, I would just say I'm a little frustrated when in this bill it allows for the use of on pets, on fabric, in hotel rooms. I just wish that agriculture was held in as high regard as the hotel industry and the pet industry. I think it's unfortunate that we're in this position here today. We're facing a litany of bills, not only in this session but in previous sessions, to try to continue to remove the tools necessary for the natural resource industry in the state, which is its largest economic driver. We all believe in the importance of the environment, otherwise we wouldn't be farmers. We all believe in the importance of the tools that we need to protect our farms, to protect our ranches, and protect our crops. So with that, I would certainly ask you and beg you to oppose this particularly draconian bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Michelle Armstrong, actually Armstrong Zielinski. I have two last names. My husband and I are both farmers outside of the Salem Brooks area. I also work for Wilbur Ellis Company, and I supply pesticides, both organic and conventional, to growers along with fertilizers. So I spend a lot of time in the field. I'd ask any of you, if you saw your dog itching and scratching and losing his hair to fleas, would you not treat him? The number one product you treat for fleas just about in the world, I believe, is imidacloprid, one of the products you guys are wanting to ban on our crops, yet you still want to be able to use it on your pests or on your dog. We watch our fields die from flea beetles. I have seen it. I didn't plant my broccoli last year with imidacloprid at planting, and I ended up spraying 3 or 4 times trying to kill the pest with something a little less effective than the imidacloprids. But I also come to you today to help explain some of the chemicals that we do use, when we use them, and maybe why we use them. We don't go out to spray just because we want to. We have to treat some pests in the soil, like your wireworms, your onion maggots, your corn maggots, and the flea beetles are best treated as a soil applied prior to the crop coming up and on the seed treatments. The reason we do this is because we cannot treat them in the soil once the pest is there. Onion maggots do not have a life cycle that you can treat once they get above the soil. Thus, we lose the entire crop. So it might sometimes seem harsh that we do a lot of preventative treatments, but unfortunately, it is the option that we have at this time. Companies are working extremely hard to find other options. Movento came out a few years ago under the name Spirotetramet. It is produced by Bayer. It is a highly effective systemic product, but it only affects aphids. This does not give us control against some of the other pests that the imidacloprids do. We use it some in greenhouses under a different name, and that will help a little bit with the whiteflies, but again, your worms and those are not controlled by this product. A new product that Bayer just came out with is Savanto. It's a group 4D, so works on the same sites as the neonics, but is very different. It is already being challenged by the environmentalists and EPA. It does carry the same bee toxicity, and the fact that it's toxic when contacted on the bees does not carry over in the flowers. We have other chemistries similar to that we don't have to worry about that, but unfortunately they don't all have the new approvals, and it's cost a lot of money and a lot of time to get this one new one coming, and it's yet to be tested. This is brand new to us within the last few months. So we look at a lot of these products and we look at them and think about $100 billion to bring one product. And the companies have to bear the cost of that. They have to bear the cost of the tests, they have to bear the cost of development, and they throw out probably 100 plus products and active ingredients to every one they bring out, and 10 to 12 years to get us those products. So when we eliminate one product in one fell swoop like this, you eliminate a huge tools to the agriculture environment and our ability to perform. The organic side, I work with a lot. Do you know that I lose probably 50% of those crops to one particular pest? Aphids. I can't control aphids. Something so simple to us on the conventional side with a product like this is almost impossible to us to control on the organic side because we don't have a product that is effective against them over a long term. And we end up spraying almost every week to get those pests, and we still lose crops to them. So if I guess I'll just open it up for questions if anybody has them.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Okay. Okay. Thank you each for being here and the insightful testimony. That's everybody that signed up. Is there anybody here that would like to testify on this bill that did not sign up? Okay. See anybody? So any comments or questions from the committee? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 882. And good job today, committee. We got through everything. Only 3 minutes over. So we'll adjourn. 3 minutes over.